this talk, you will know as much as I do. They're called submillimeter galaxies, which usually are dusty starburst galaxies, which usually flips a cognitive switch in theorists. But they're very interesting. So this entire field is about a decade old, okay? Because of technology and, because of technology, these galaxies which emit between 200 microns and a millimeter were virtually not observed except at very low redshift, where they're really bright. The SCUBA survey, a little over 10 years ago, produced this result, which plots number counts versus observed flux. And this is what it looks like. This is the Schechter function. Pretty much all these galaxies are invisible in the optical. But they are between 100 and 1,000 times brighter than the Milky Way. And they are living at extremely high redshift, redshifts 2 to 5 or so. So it's a pretty remarkable population. And there's a lot of them. This is not them, but this is almost them. This is like sub-submillimeter. These telescopes have resolution of about this, okay, like 15 or 20 arc seconds. So these are follow-up observations with Hubble and Spitzer. So just so you have a picture of them, they might look like this, except that they're even redder. And so in Spitzer, you see that they're getting brighter. So what we know about them is that they have extremely high star formation rates, hundreds to 1,000 solar masses per year. For reference, anything that's producing more than 10 stars per year is called a starburst. And they are completely optically obscured by dust. So there's like little globs of intense star formation enshrouded by just enough dust that they are extincted by like tens of magnitudes in optical. They're quite rare at low redshift, but they are the dominant population in the sense of dominating the star formation in the universe, dominating the luminosity at sufficiently high redshifts. And they are almost equally bright, if not brighter, in this range of redshifts between 2 to 10. Okay? So.
But if you just take their. You extrapolate a little bit, and you take their volumetric luminosity and number density, then they appear to be dominating all optically observed galaxies. So they're stars, right? 10,000 Kelvin bright. All their light's absorbed by dust and re-emitted at these really cold temperatures, which is why this is another picture of. Now this is submillimeter contours and optical data in black and white, and you see there's almost no correlation. Super bright submillimeter galaxies, almost nothing in the optical. And so these are believed to be the progenitors of large elliptical galaxies. There's some merging going on, which is producing star formation, and once all that is over, you're left with nice elliptical galaxies.
So this is a preview of what I want to show you, build up to towards the end of the talk, that this is all the data that we have on submillimeter galaxies. Remember I showed you this? This was the best we had up to a few years ago, and you know this was a Schechter function. We spent a year building a lensing model that made predictions, and they felt pretty lonely because they produced an amplification of the counts due to high magnification effects, but there was no data. In all optical surveys, by the way, this region is not observed as well, right? It's like a factor of 10 in luminosity compared to L star, but you can see there's like 5 or 6 orders of magnitude in number counts. So, none. This is a prediction.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's a prediction.
Okay. Yeah. this was the data, this was the prediction, and we felt a little sad. I mean, the Schechter function is from 1976, so we didn't do anything new there. No, I'm So a few years ago, there was one data point here, and then a couple of months ago, the SPT survey, you know, the famous submillimeter galaxy detection survey, found I didn't use the word SD explicitly. Right.
They found
a population of extremely interesting, super bright sources. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little more, but these are basically, you know, pretty wide range in wavelength, factor of 3, huge range in luminosity, and they were believed to be 2, 3, 4 different classes of galaxies at different redshifts generating this data. But we seem to be finding that that a single population model, once you include lensing, is consistent with all the data. So I want to explain that story to you. Magnification, what are we talking about? You know, how lensing involves the mapping of source to image plane, and you get a magnification as a result of convergence, that is mass density, and shear, which also contributes to magnification. It's a nonlinear quantity, which can blow up in two different ways. And it produces observable effects where you can go from the outskirts of a galaxy cluster and get magnifications of 5% towards the inner parts and get magnifications of a factor of 100. That's in the real universe. So what we're going to need is the probability to produce a certain amount of magnification in blank fields and galaxy clusters to make contact with data. So as any good theorist, we start with halos that have an NFW profile. And then it has a nice property that you can calculate analytically the magnification profiles of dark matter halos. So you take your 3D profile, you project it, because our lensing only cares about the surface density. You weight with the lens efficiency to get the convergence on the sky. And from that, you, through a non-local operation, you get the shear, the distortions, and both of these go into calculating the magnification profile of a halo. This fails completely to reproduce what is seen in the universe. So spherical NFW halos are great for almost everything, but not for lensing. At the very least, you need to add ellipticity, which greatly amplifies the high magnification cross-section. So then you have magnification profiles as a function of theta 1 and theta 2. Yeah, we do a little baryonic fudge at the end.
Yeah, something like that is true. So in the field of strong lensing, there are two disconnected universes, the universe of clusters and arcs, and that of multiply imaged quasars, and there's no single theoretical model that explains them, either through simulations or analytical stuff, so people just do something very empirical to get quasar multiple images, and then for clusters, you do something like that.
Yeah, so in other words, how do you know it is ellipticity rather than simply the change in the slope of the profile? That would explain
the... There's no easy way to know. So cross-sections are incredibly sensitive to ellipticity, substructure, and central concentration. But broadly speaking, for clusters, ellipticity appears to do the job, and for galaxies, it's the centrally peaked profiles. Correct. We don't address all of that in detail. We do kind of fit to some simulations and empirical knowledge at the end. So we're going to use ellipticity as a tunable parameter. So we might go to extreme values like these. So this is what you see in the sky. The cluster is about twice as big.
Sorry. So can you just calibrate this from simulations instead of putting these things by hand?
Yes. And then you're stuck with a simulation that has sigma 8 of 0.9 and overpredicts things by factors of 5. So what I mean to say is that magnification effects are so sensitive to so many, not so many, but several ingredients that you need to be able to redo things a lot. And you need high resolution simulations. So we calibrate for some choice of parameters, but then as you'll see, we're going to vary them a lot. And we're particularly interested in halos of what mass at what redshift are doing the lensing. And that's much, much easier to do with a halo model than a simulation. So the magnification goes from like a few percent to tens of percent to factors of 2 to rapidly factors of 10 and 50. So this is 0.6 off minutes on the side. And this is where you get infinite magnification in principle, but in practice, the finite sizes of galaxies means you get factors of up to 100. So what's varying is the electricity, as I'll be trying to figure out. So we populate the whole sky with a distribution of halos that have a right mass function, redshift evolution, and all that. And then we calculate probabilities by just calculating the areas on the sky that each halo contributes of a certain magnification. So this is a 10 to the 15 solar mass halo. And you know, you integrate over halo mass and the line of sight, and you get an optical depth and a probability. This part of the probability we don't care about. We're interested in magnifications, the factors of 2 to 10s. And so there's some measurements for simulations that come with their own caveats, but we're able to match them quite well by tuning the electricity appropriately. A nice thing about this asymptotic slope is that it actually approaches quite closely the mu to the minus 3 scaling that you get from like a very simple analytical argument by looking at how the magnification falls off an isolated caustic. It has to go like 1 over square root of theta. And from that, you get an asymptotic scaling for high magnification, which in practice appears to be what halos produce.
So this curve, this blue curve, is for E of 0.4 in the potential. So
right.
Density, what does that correspond to?
It's quite ridiculous. Yeah. I think it's between 0.7 and 0.8. So we are virtually making our halos disky
right.
To get the high magnification, which is our way of compensating for crust-free profiles and substructure. Well, that's what the simulations see. So in the simulation, there's one side of the contribution. I'll talk about these caveats a little more at the end. Right. So the main thing we want to calculate is what magnification does to the counts of galaxies as a function of observed flux, a very simple quantity. So magnification increases flux because it increases the area, and it increases solid angles as well.
So if you're interested in the number density of galaxies per unit solid angle per unit flux, then you get 1 over mu squared suppression from the flux and the solid angle that's implicit in the denominator. And then the observed flux corresponds to an intrinsic flux that's given by, for which you need to divide by the magnification. So simple, well-known relation between observed counts and intrinsic unlensed counts of galaxies.
Yes?
How do you do that?
Not very well, but I'll tell you a little more in a few slides. So we got a bit confused. This literature is 3 decades old, but people were mostly interested in the case of constant magnification on correlation functions. So the case where you need to average over a cluster field or any spatially varied magnification field has some conflicting expressions, so we think we came up with a really clear once and for all derivation, which is far from it, as even our referee told us. It's even presented in this paper, so like we have this two-page definition in the referee's beforehand, like, here's how I think about it. In like four sentences, he derived, or she derived this equation for us. This field kind of moved from community to community, so there was the community of angular clustering magnification bias, and there's the quasar community. Now there's the cluster SZ community that needs to deal with these magnification effects. So we looked at counts and fluxes and tried to give every kind of expression you might need.
When you say mu, the average of mu there, is that average over the whole universe or average over?
So if you're averaging over the whole universe, it's one.
That's right.
Right. But we'll also apply it to cluster fields, where it's bigger than one.
So it's average over clusters.
I'm going to do both cases.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A lot of the subtlety in these expressions comes from whether you're working in the image plane or the source plane. You get factors of one of the meaning that differ, and that leads to some confusion. So the probabilities that I'm talking about are
source plane probabilities, which is what you want if you want to know what fraction of sources are magnified by a certain amount. Right, so some of the questions you've been raising, how large are the sources? How massive and disturbed and irregular are the lenses? These things make a big difference. I'm showing here a simulation and data. So this is source plane magnification over a wide area from these guys. And you see some caustics. Sorry, the reproduction isn't as good on the screen. But you also see a lot of irregular structures that are far from anything analytical. And the regions of high magnification get dramatically bright. With the help of stuff like this, there's an arc here that you can't see, but it's been reproduced in this color reconstruction. So there's these beautiful lens models that people make of multiple image systems and groups and clusters. So these are critical curves and caustics, and you can see that by placing two finite size sources, one of these is the model and one of these is the data, you can see they match pretty well. It matters exactly where the source is, how large it is, how large this caustic is relative to the other one. So, the inner one wouldn't even exist in a spherically symmetric system. So you really have to get the structure of the lens right to do this. From the theory side, we really don't know, as you go from cluster to group to galaxy scales, how the degree of ellipticity and substructure vary and how they evolve with redshift. From the observational side, unlike for optical galaxies, we don't know how big these submillimeter galaxies are. The vast majority has been observed with resolutions of between 10 arc seconds and an arc minute. They're almost certainly smaller than half an arc second, possibly as small as 0.1 arc seconds. So where they lie in that range makes a big difference, because if you're sitting on a caustic, which part of your galaxy is getting highly magnified and multiply imaged makes a difference to the total magnification. It's not as hopeless as I'm making it sound, because if halos of 10 to the 13 and upward, typically 10 to the 14, are making a big contribution, then the galaxy size, which is, say, 0.2 arc seconds, is much smaller than the size of the caustic, which is, say, 5 arc seconds. And in that case, the point source approximation isn't terrible. But as I'll show in a few slides, there's some uncertainty about what contribution we are getting from isolated elliptical galaxies and there these scales may be comparable. So that's probably the main source of uncertainty in our predictions.
Okay,
that's why we have these bands. If you look carefully, they're like a factor of 3 or so in uncertainty. So that's a significant uncertainty, which folds in sigma 8 and finite source size and baryonic effects. So with all of those caveats, this is sort of the bottom line of the story, that you have these observations, which were usually explained as a combination of a starburst population and a normal population, one of which is at high redshift, and some combination is at very low redshift. In this point, there's known sources that are being identified at low redshift, and they appear to be about a third of the sources. So for various reasons, as you go to shorter wavelengths, you get more and more of a low redshift population. At these wavelengths, nobody really knows, but we think what's going on is that you have galaxies being magnified by factors of 10 to 30. So fairly typical galaxies sitting over here, a few Millijansky that are getting magnified into the 20 to 40 Millijansky range that SPT observes. These guys were not seen before because SPT has carried out a 87 square degree survey, which is what you need to find these relatively rare events that's less than 1 per square degree. So the picture we have is that you have these 10 to the 13, 14 halos, and you have galaxies that are, you know, less than 1 less than 1 per square arc minute, and so every, you know, 1 in 1,000 of them is sitting behind a critical curve, is sitting behind a caustic and getting highly magnified. Fortunately, Gil tells me that there's follow-up observations, so some of the predictions that we ventured to make about what kind of optical imaging will reveal the groups or clusters that are doing the lensing is going to happen pretty soon. So finding the lenses and resolving the sources to maybe see the arcs is the way to settle some of the story. And both of them are going to happen because you can resolve the sources with interferometry.
This is a typical mass of a lens in this model.
I'm coming to that. I think we're on this slide. We've scaled the predictions by a single parameter. Okay. So the total number density of these galaxies comes from a single population. There's a parameter. The asymptotic slope is fixed by the data and by not wanting to exceed the known infrared background. And so there's just one free parameter, and that is scaled with frequency in a way that's consistent with this picture of these galaxies having a black body. You're observing the Rayleigh Jeans part of it with some emissivity correction. So there's some constraints on what that scaling is. And so we find something that goes as at start on like mu squared works well. So there's big uncertainties, but it sure seems to hang together. That's the story. This is the variation with redshift. So in order to get the significant boost, redshift 1 will not do. Redshift 2 seems to underpredict. You really need the sources to be at redshift bigger than 2. Empirically, we have no handle on the upper limit of their redshift, and unfortunately, lensing isn't sensitive either because the distance isn't growing much beyond redshift 3. Right. So now we can use this Hiller model to do a number of things quite easily. One is figure out how much these sources were magnified by.
So my claim that these were a few Millikansky sources that were boosted by factors of 10 to 20 comes from this plot that shows the mean magnification as a function of observed flux. And all those points from Vieira et al. Are at are at tens of Millikansky. Actually, I think I'm actually talking about the 1.4 millimeter observations here. So it's these points that are at 10 to 40 or 50 Millikansky. So this curve is for that population. And so to get 10 to 50 Millikansky, you could go through this transition from magnifications of less than 2 to very quickly bigger than 10. Okay, and that comes from the steep Schechter function. So that's why for most of these guys you need factors of 10 to 30. And who's providing that effect? Well, in our model, that effect is being dominated by halos in the 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 14 solar mass range at redshifts between 0.5 and 1. Okay? It's not very sensitive to the degree of magnification once you're in this regime. Simulations have studied, so Hilbert et al. Took their dark matter simulations and then did a recipe for adding galaxies with appropriate, you know, observed concentrations, and they found that you raise the 10 to the 13 contribution by about a factor of 2. So they get an almost bimodal distribution. But they're still not quite able to reproduce observed quasar images. So we don't have a very good model for this range, and we're almost certainly underestimating its contribution. But we think that underestimation is in the factor of 2 range over here, and so you should still be finding a significant number of group 2 modest cluster halos that are doing this lensing. So that's a prediction that could well be proven wrong very quickly. Some of the follow-up observations are in hand, and there's some intriguing results that you're probably not at liberty to reveal yet. But it's not hard to find. I mean, in optical imaging, you know, if you take a 24th magnitude R-band, I-band image and we talk about this as if it's a new thing, but of course Mike Gladys and co have been doing this for 10 years as a way to find clusters. But it's not easy to find these modest size groups and clusters at redshift 1, because unless you happen to know where they might be. So, so let's see. Okay, so that was the story. These sources, remember, were found by surveys looking for SD clusters. So I'll spend just a couple of minutes talking about how these galaxies might contaminate your SD signal. So this is your SD decrement increment after you subtract the background as a function of frequency. Up until this point, I didn't do what is completely standard in the literature, that in any paragraph or sentence, you need to use microns, millimeters, and gigahertz. Like, very effective way of keeping the non-experts out. But now I am using gigahertz also. So the mean flux contributed by these galaxies, doing a little bit of extrapolating from the blast data, is quite large. But it's subtracted along with the background CMB. So what you care about is the contribution due to Poisson fluctuations of the galaxies that sit behind the field. It could be positive. It could be negative. This is the one sigma. I mean, these
galaxies just fill the whole sky, right? These are high redshift galaxies uncorrelated with the cluster. Okay. And, you know, they're sort of unresolved. So they're just like a background.
But they have different frequency dependence in the same way, right?
Right. Right.
So they, when you subtract them, when
so in a given channel, they would get subtracted, right? But behind a particular cluster, you might have an up or down fluctuation. Okay. So it's that RMS fluctuation contribute.
I'm talking about the two-point function. Okay, yeah, okay.
So, but if let's say you buy the same cluster, why the background calculations should be fairly possible?
Right. So that correlation is represented by the mean flux isn't changed because Lenzing conserves surface brightness. So the mean flux isn't changed. The fluctuations are. So this is a sort of easier to interpret plot, which shows you that the error bars on an SD detection kind of start to blow up as you go to high frequencies. Because these galaxies have sitting on the Rayleigh genes, their contribution rises with frequency pretty rapidly. This is a
this is the kind of cluster that surveys are detecting, 4 times 10 to the 14 solar masses. This is a big cluster. So the damage done is heavier on the small clusters. So this is the unlensed contribution. This is if you include the lensing. And you can see that at the decrement, it's a 10% level, which is not terrible. But a 10% scatter that's not factored in is going to screw up your results because your counts are falling steeply. And at the increment, the news is quite bad, so you may not detect anything at all, or even smaller mass clusters, you could get negative fluctuations. All right, that's my summary. I've tried to convey that we're talking about this exciting population of galaxies, and folding and magnification, we appear to have a very simple explanation for all the data. The story is almost certainly more complicated than that. There I'm sure, are multiple types of populations, but this very high redshift, pretty normal Schechter function population appears to be the dominant one. And we look forward to the resolution of some of these puzzles about who's doing the lensing, at what redshift, are there arcs, and are there multiple images, and so on.
So, are these things big arcs in your model for the most part?
Yeah.
So, like 10-to-1 or 10-to-arcs?
Not necessarily. But there are certainly arcs. Like, if you look at a cluster and look at everything that has a high magnification, some fraction of it is 10-to-1, and there's others that are not that extreme, but they are bright arcs. I think 10-to-1 qualifies as giant arcs in the dark.
So what's the probability for a cluster at the mass of, let's say, 10 to the 15 to have a bright source multiplied by factor of 3?
Right. For 10 to the 15, that's better than, that's certainly better than 1 in 10, but I don't know.
It totally depends on what kind of source you're talking.
For these sources that are redshifts of 2 and hundredths per square degree, I don't know that it's 1 in 2, but it's certainly better than 1 in 10.
So, I guess you just said this, but maybe I missed it. But by what fraction do SD fluxes change due to these things?
Yes, yeah,
that
would be nice.
So that was this plot, right? For a cluster of this mass, 2/3 of them will be changed by.
What fraction of the actual SD flux is it?
Oh, I see. By meter?
Because I care about how reliable SD is.
Or even just to be able to see that and convert it to temperatures. Mm-hmm.
Should SDR people that worry about this?
I mean, if you divide the sure. width of the curve by the curve, yeah. isn't that what you're looking for?
Maybe I am.
This is delta S, right? So delta S over S is what you're looking for.
But is this like the RMS fluctuation in the flux? Or?
So this is saying that what you'll observe
okay.
is in this range 2/3 of the time.
Like,
so you may get a zero signal, or you may get twice the
okay.
signal.
Okay, so it's huge, basically. That's
yeah.
And the increment size for modest size.
Wouldn't this distribution have long tails? So sometimes you have probability to see a very bright guy, and most of the time, single ones.
Now, this contribution is not dominated by the very high magnification events.
It's
dominated by magnification of less than 2 events.
So what this says is you shouldn't do a SIM service of 500 gigahertz. And nobody does.
Plunk.
But that's even without the lensing, right?
The SAT and the SCA work at 30 megahertz.
Wait on that.
The SCA is at 30 megahertz.
But it's not even the lensing.
So, 90, 220, and this is what, 270 or 300 is where as these channels tend to be.
The channel for the signal is typically from the back of the channel. But this is not a signal.
Right.
Well, yeah.
But even at
different strategies and different strategies.
But even at 150, it seems very. It's huge to me, though, actually. So for 10 to 14, for
6.
6 mm-hmm. masses, right? That's what people detect in this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even at 150.
It's a 10% contribution. It gets to be 20-30% if you're
quickly,
aiming to go down to 10 to 14.
And then if you put, the CD galaxies, massive CD galaxies in the center of these scales, will the probabilities change?
Yes, so our lensing is somewhat of an underestimate because we're using a smooth model. there are other contaminants, right? These galaxies could be sitting inside the clusters, in which case we couldn't subtract their mean contribution, but that's believed to be at the 10% level, at least over here. There's radio galaxies which have a different spectrum.
People are getting
some understanding of that as well. But this appears to be the dominant contribution for smallish clusters around them now, for sure.
But for some perspective, I mean, that the main thing that you're seeing is just the background from these galaxies, not lensed. Like, just the RMS background for SPT, the dusty galaxies are about half our thermal nodes. And so if we have a 5-sigma object, 10% of that thing's flux is the dusty galaxy background. And that's what that top lot is, right?
That's right.
And it's just saying that the sky is full of these dusty galaxies.
Right.
And it's a huge background.
What do you do with that?
It's just noise.
Don't try and go deeper than the noise will let you go.
Are they optically thin, these dusty galaxies? Like, if they sit in front of a cluster, do they sit through? Are they really just like a noise?
Well, they're mostly behind the clusters, but if you get somewhat farther up, at some point they'll become obviously thick, but not at 220 gigahertz.
But why is this plus minus? Isn't this always plus?
Oh, it's subtracted from
the mean.
So this is the mean and. A symmetric version of this band is the RMS.
The lensing can serve surface brightness, right? So the mean isn't affected by the lens.
But it depends on the profile that you fit. So, I mean, the total may be conserved, but I mean, if you have a finite aperture, is that still?
That's too true.
It's still true, okay.
I'm interested in your four-line reasoning for why one factor mu is outside, one factor mu is inside the integral.
Oh, I see.
Is it because one of them has the width, the change in angle, and that is outside, and then the change in flux that is inside? Is that what's going on?
Not really. It's it goes from right. So it's from the fact that the speed of meal that we are using is in the source plane. Which for various reasons we do, and it's conventional. But you could have used a P of mu in the image plane, in which case it would just be this. So it's a source plane, image plane.
All right.
Okay,
other questions? Mm-hmm.